مساء الخير جميعا. I'm truly honored tonight to welcome all of you to this very important event. And thank you for joining us both in person and online, because we have also some participants online. Before we begin, I kindly ask all of you to join me in a minute of silence dedicated to honor the lives of our people in Palestine, to all the Palestinians who were killed in this brutal and fascist genocide happening and still happening until now in Gaza, and for all Palestinians, shuhada, martyrs, since 1948 and even beyond, an estimated number of 150,000 Palestinians who have been killed while fighting and resisting this long-standing Israeli colonization, ethnic cleansing, occupation, and non-stop genocide. Something that can clearly tell us how the logic of eliminating Palestinians have been always within the DNA of Zionism, Israeli colonization, and occupation. So please, a minute of silence. Ever since, the Israeli colonial project has been always supported by complicit economies in the West. Israeli colonization has long been established and sustained by complicit Western economies through a web of military aid, trade agreements, and corporate investments that normalize and profit from occupation and genocide. The United States alone provides over $4 billion annually in military aid, while the EU and other Western powers countries, including this country, grant Israel easy routes to trade access, even to goods produced and services in Israeli illegal settlements in the West Bank, despite clear and very much clear violations of international law. Multinational corporations like Caterpillar, HP, Airbnb, and more, much more, have directly profited from or enabled settlement expansion, surveillance of Palestinians on each and every day, home demolitions, genocidal killing, while Israeli cybersecurity firms export technologies tested on Palestinians to police forces and governments worldwide. Western banks as well, pension funds, continue to invest in companies embedded in the occupation economy. And that's why BDS is important. And that's why BDS is crucial, needed these days and in the future. Today, it's such a great pleasure and such a great opportunity to gather here in the spirit of critical discussion, political reflection, and engaged scholarship, to speak about the role of big tech, firms like Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and others in the ongoing genocide in Gaza, through the provision of technology and services to Israel's military and leading weapons companies. We are going to hear today, and hopefully and definitely learn more, about the interaction of militarized surveillance data with AI and cloud computing technologies, and how these systems enable new forms of autonomous weapons for enacting genocide in Gaza and beyond. Before I introduce my esteemed speaker for tonight, I would love to thank some people. First of all, she left, but I'd love to thank Jenny for helping me organizing this, and wish her a happy birthday because she wanted to celebrate her birthday. I would love also to thank the Middle East Center Fellows. That was lovely meeting you all. And to all the friends and the people that I met here in Oxford, honestly, just knowing you and meeting you made my fellowship much more enjoyable. Tonight, we are truly honored to have Dr. Samer Abdel-Noor, who whose work, to be honest, stands at the powerful intersection of scholarship and activism. Samer, the way he likes to be called, not doctor, is a senior lecturer at the University of Edinburgh. He's currently working on a number of projects at the intersection of technology and violence. In a recent essay titled Make a Killing, he explores the link between innovation and violence by examining how Israel's success as a startup nation is tied to systematic oppression of the Palestinian people. He co-founded Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, and served as a board member for a long period of time. When we speak, to be honest, about critical and engaged scholars, who mobilize their academic projects and work into activism, we are definitely speaking about you, Samer, to be honest, who is aware of the importance of this intersection between scholarship and activism in bringing research that supports reparation and liberation, not objectification, violence normalization, and complicity. When political reflexivity in our research is missed out or ignored intentionally in our research and teaching. I believe that this is crucial for all of us in this hard time during the genocide, as academics, students, and researchers, to ask ourselves and rethink and revisit why we are engaged in academia. What for? Are we challenging hegemonic structures of oppression, violence, neoliberalism, or are we just reproducing these structures in a fancy, trendy academic words? In your paper, Samer, Researching Violent Contexts, A Call for Political Reflexivity, a paper that I couldn't leave, to be honest, without reading each and every bit of it, you said, and I'm quoting you in here, the desire to decolonize is not alone sufficient, as there's always a risk that critical research reinforces discursive power structures. From this perspective, political reflexivity at the borders of reparation, liberation can be said to involve both internal and external critique of the researcher slash research within the context of colonial, post-colonial modes of knowledge production, and with the epistemic privilege and lived experiences of marginalized people who aspire for an alternative paradigm beyond their existing colonial, post-colonial condition. What is most important, we believe, is a precise articulation of what reparation and or liberation mean and for whom, a quote that summarizes your engaged work. Whether through writing, teaching, organizing, or public events like these, you exemplify what it means to think critically and act. We are very fortunate, Samer, to have you with us tonight, so please join me in a warmly welcoming to Dr. Samer Aftanur.
Thank you, Eugene, for having me as well, and the Middle East Center. Thank you, Jenny, for all the work you've done to organize this, and thanks to everyone for being here today. Before I begin, I'd also like to give a nod for those students here at Oxford who are facing disciplinary action from administration for their principled protest against genocide complicity. So we see you, and thank you, and we stand with you. Many of you will know that just recently, this past February in fact, Google dropped its ethical AI and no weapons development pledge, signaling what it avoided disclosing publicly for years, which is that technology that it develops is being used for controversial weapons it advanced during the genocide in Gaza together with Amazon through Project Nimbus, a $1.2 billion US contract with the State of Israel signed just 4 years ago in 2021. Google's ethical AI policy was formulated in 2018 after widespread protests by its own employees, thousands in fact, over something called Project Maven, a contract to provide AI and other services to the US Pentagon. Google and Amazon are not the only big tech firms involved in the provision of tech that's being used in Gaza today. In a recent document leak, it was revealed that after October 7, Microsoft jumped at the chance to provide its technology and services to Israel, including Israel's military and its notorious cyber warfare unit, Unit 8200, whose members can today be found working across Israel's tech startup scene, but also in positions of strategic importance across all of the big tech companies. One Microsoft employee also reportedly discovered her code being used, among other things, to translate and categorize Palestinian voices from recordings taken in Gaza. And these are fed into targeting systems, which I'll explain more in a little bit. Palantir, which last year signed a $174 million US contract with the US Army for AI-supported targeting, has also not been shy about its strategic partnership with Israel and Israel's military, which Palantir's CEO refers to as crucial operations happening in the weeks after October 7. To grasp how big tech enables genocide, we need to understand first Israel and military occupation as a surveillance state that not only governs nearly every facet of Palestinian life, but generates immense data about Palestinians that is then weaponized within and monetized by what I call Israel's military innovation ecosystem. As my colleague and digital rights advocate Marwa Fatafta has said, believe us when we say we are a surveillance testing lab in every sense of the word. Surveillance of Palestinians under occupation has always been pervasive, but over the past 20 years it has escalated through mandated biometric ID cards for Palestinians, facilitating greater tracking of movement and data collection. Over the past 8 years, Israel's military began using facial recognition technology at checkpoints en masse, technology often initiated in so-called hotspots, such as Hebron or Khalil, before being deployed across occupied Palestine. Surveillance and facial recognition systems aren't simply passive, but they include apps that are developed for soldiers to collect data about Palestinians on their smartphones. These come under a variety of names, White Wolf, Red Wolf, Blue Wolf, etc., and they're used to populate a database known as Wolfpack. Data might be collected when stopping Palestinians at checkpoints, at schools, when breaking into homes, including night raids, where entire families, including children, are frequently photographed. The Wolfpack database is also populated via data scraped from social media sites, CCTV cameras, etc. Information from Wolfpack is also fed back to soldiers in real time. So when someone is scanned at a checkpoint, for instance, soldiers are provided information about that person and notified if they are classified as a potential target or threat. There are many other surveillance technologies that are being utilized as well against Palestinians. Some of you might have heard of AnyVision, a facial recognition and tracking software initially funded by a Microsoft incubator. AnyVision was also partially developed at my institution, the University of Edinburgh, through a funded project on the use of signal processing for the defense sector. In Gaza, a large part of the surveillance data is made up of mobile data. Calls, messaging, location tracking, and associated data points collected from over 1 million mobile phone subscriptions, tracked by way of triangulating and using cell towers, which are reported as being used for real-time monitoring of population movements, even now during the genocide. Israel restricted wireless access in Gaza for the longest time to 2G, and more recently to 3G, which rendered data more easily intercepted over systems like 4G or 5G. Surveillance data in Gaza is also collected via facial recognition software and administrative tracking, especially when people move through crossings. It has also been reported that both Israeli forces and US mercenaries are using facial and retina scanning at checkpoints. When people on the move between humanitarian kill zones, when people are taken hostage, to prison camps, or even when they're at supposed aid distribution centers. These surveillance systems and the databases they populate are further weaponized and utilized for genocide through cloud computing and AI technology that is provided to Israel through big tech, which enable autonomous weapon systems, which are otherwise referred to or commonly referred to as killer robots. These are part of a new digital class of weapons involving programs that draw on immense amounts of data to generate and execute kill lists with minimal to no meaningful human involvement or oversight, meaning no one to appropriately assess, interrogate, or verify, sometimes even authorize, the kill lists that are generated. And it's worthy to note that at a November 2024 meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, states overwhelmingly voted to propose a treaty or a ban to ban such autonomous weapon systems, and the UK actually voted in favor of that. So this is where Project Nimbus comes in. Project Nimbus is a contracted partnership between the State of Israel and US-based Alphabet, which is Google's parent company, and Amazon. It began as an Israeli initiative to significantly upgrade its government technology systems across the board. It's a project that was led by the Ministry of Finance, but with full involvement of the Israeli military from day one. And it aimed to pick preferred cloud providers that would build new data centers in Israel to store data securely inside Israel, but also to provide it access with leading AI and cloud computing technology. Google and Amazon were picked over other bidders, most notably a coalition of Microsoft and Oracle, because of their specific AI and machine learning capabilities. In May 2021, the same week Israel killed over 250 people in Gaza, including more than 60 children, Google and Amazon formally signed the $1.2 billion contract, US dollars, with the State of Israel. At a high level, Project Nimbus involves Google and Amazon building and optimizing AI and cloud computing for the Israeli government and every sector of Israeli society. This includes its military, its police, agencies that govern settlements, as well as its leading state-owned weapons companies. As part of the contract, Amazon would build three data centers in Israel, Google would spend hundreds of millions to set up cloud infrastructure, and both Google and Amazon committed to reciprocal purchases and industrial cooperation to the equivalent of 20% of the value of the contract, so reinvesting back into Israel to develop technology capabilities. As reported in a Time report, an investigative report, Project Nimbus gave the Israeli Ministry of Defense its own landing zone into Google Cloud, a secure entry point to Google-provided computing infrastructure, which would allow the ministry to directly store and process data, to access AI services, and to, quote, assist with the architecture, design, implementation, guidance, and automation of Israeli military activity. The ministry also sought consulting assistance from Google to expand Google Cloud access on multiple occasions, to access automation technologies, and this was according to a draft contract that was released by The Intercept, March 27th, 2024. The contract shows Google billing the Israeli military, and its Ministry of Defense over $1 million for consulting services. Google also is reported to have given Israel a steep discount, 15%, on all consulting fees as part of the Nimbus framework. Further, after October 2023, Google began providing its updated Vertex AI and graphics processing units technology to Israel's military in order to further increase its capability in image analysis processing. In November 2024, it was reported that Google made its Gemini AI models, which can process documents as well as audio files, available to Israel's military. All of these models were initially trained on internet data, public data. I think that's something that's important for us to keep in mind. It's also important to note that as part of the contract, Google and Amazon are contractually barred from having any oversight into how its technology is being deployed, even in the case of suspected human rights abuses. Moreover, the contract requires Google and Amazon to quote-unquote reject, appeal, and resist any request for information, including from legal bodies, and only respond after consultation with Israel. Google employees have also stated more generally that the company has very little ability to monitor or provide any oversight to what its customers, especially states like Israel, are doing on its cloud infrastructure. And recent revelations show that Google executives understood very well they could not prevent Israel from utilizing these technologies for war crimes. In fact, Google insiders have been very clear that at every point executives were aware of warning signs that Project Nimbus would be utilized for grave violations of human rights, and they still chose to continue with it. And the project continues today, even with confirmation that this technology is enabling genocide, even in the face of pressures from employees and movements like the No Tech for Apartheid movement. Now, for a long time, there was very little known about Project Nimbus. Both Google and Amazon were extremely quiet about it. When it was discovered, Google initially denied any military link. A Google spokesperson is quoted as saying, quote, "We have been very clear that the Nimbus contract is for workloads running on our commercial platform by Israeli government ministries such as finance, healthcare, transportation, and education." Quote, "It is not relevant to weapons or intelligence services." Amazon has still not officially discussed the contract, but repeats standard corporate jargon about serving customers wherever they are and that clients have a right to defend themselves. Yet the evidence is quite convincing. Project Nimbus enables AI-informed autonomous weapon systems that generate kill lists at unprecedented speed with minimal to no human engagement, which over the past 20 months has enabled the unprecedented scale and intensity of bombardment and destruction that we have all witnessed in Gaza, live streamed. The reason for the large number of targets and the extensive harm to people and infrastructure, both in Gaza and in Lebanon, is the widespread use of these various AI-informed systems that, as a result of Project Nimbus, are able to process the immense amount of surveillance data Israel had collected over decades in order to present them as military targets. So this is really fundamental to understand. One system that we know of is called Hapsora, or the Gospel, which is largely built on AI and can generate targets almost automatically at a rate that far exceeds what was ever previously possible. This AI system, as described by a former intelligence officer, essentially facilitates what they call, in quote, a mass assassination factory. Hapsora is said to focus on the targeting of buildings and essential infrastructure. Another system is called Lavender. Lavender focuses on people. It analyzes information collected on most of the then 2.3 million residents of Gaza, now speculated to be closer to 1.8 million, including children, who make up nearly 50% of Gaza's population. Lavender works by analyzing data collected via mass surveillance, which it then assesses and ranks according to the likelihood that each person is active in resistance. So every person that information is collected on gets put through this system, and every person is ranked between 1 in 100, expressing how likely they are a militant. Again, even children. Lavender learns to identify characteristics of known targets whose information was fed to the machine as training data, but then it functions to locate these same characteristics, also called features, among the data representing the general population. This is what these language models do. An individual found to have several different incriminating features will receive a high rating and thus automatically becomes a potential target for assassination. Another system which you might have heard about is called Where's Daddy? Where's Daddy is effectively a tracking and targeting system that combines data from Lavender and ranks every person in Gaza as a target, but using mobile tracking. As the name suggests, it is designed to produce a notification when a suspected target reaches home when they're with their family. And that's why, where's daddy? With these systems, a military analyst doesn't need to go through any information. The system does that for them. It presents a target, and where there is an analyst present, their function is usually just to click a button to approve, setting an attack in motion, often without knowing how the system functions or on what basis a target is generated. And so what advocates who are working against this notion of killer robot have said is that because the function of these soldiers are effectively reduced to clicking approval, and because the soldiers tend to have very little information about how the systems work or what, or an ability to verify or interrogate that information, they too effectively are becoming a robot as part of that machine. So it's their argument against the claim that these targets are vetted by humans. Targets are generated and selected based on several categories: tactical targets, underground targets, power targets, family homes, operative homes. These systems enable manipulation of settings that relax who is or who is not suspected of being part of the resistance, such that the widest number of people become what are called power targets. These systems can also direct attacks to take place when a target is at home, such as Where's Daddy, when they're home with their family or in a civilian building. Moreover, the system boundaries, where they are relaxed, they can be relaxed to the point where hundreds of civilians are deemed acceptable casualties for targeting one suspected member of a resistance group. This is one explanation as to why we've seen entire buildings leveled and entire families wiped off the civil registry. Entire bloodlines disappeared because the boundaries of these systems are relaxed to the point that allow, in military speak, what is referred to as collateral damage, high collateral damage. The ability of these systems to be relaxed, these boundaries, depends often on a soldier's rank. A more junior soldier may be able to relax the boundaries such that a dozen people would be permitted to be killed or as collateral. But a senior officer, in the case of a high-profile target, may be able to relax the boundaries such that they approve a target where 100 or 200 people are deemed acceptable for being killed, in addition to the target. The current commander of Israel's cyber warfare unit, 8200, advocated in a book that he wrote for the development of such systems because, in his views, humans are a quote-unquote bottleneck, limiting the army's capability during military operations. According to him, quote, "We humans cannot process so much information. It doesn't matter how many people you have tasked to produce targets during the war. You still cannot produce enough targets per day." For him, the solution was an AI-enabled quote-unquote target machine that can create quote-unquote tens of thousands of targets, which is exactly what Google and Amazon have enabled Israel to do. Now, while where Google and Amazon were for the longest time quite quiet about their involvement in Project Nimbus, Israeli officials haven't been so quiet. So what have Israeli officials said about Project Nimbus? In February 2024, at a conference dedicated to Project Nimbus, the head of Israel's National Cyber Directorate stated, "Phenomenal things are happening in battle because of the Nimbus public cloud, things that are impactful for victory." On July 10th, 2024, the commander of Israel's Army Center for Computing and Information Systems, which provides data processing for the entire military, spoke at a conference titled IT for IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, where she confirmed Israel's using cloud storage and artificial intelligence provided by Google, Amazon, and Microsoft in Gaza. She described big tech's AI and cloud computing infrastructure as a quote-unquote weapons platform, which includes apps and programs for military targeting, for bombing, a portal to view for viewing live footage from unmanned vehicles, including drones, as well as fire command and control systems, meaning deployment of munitions and destruction of people and infrastructure. Another Israeli military source confirmed Google and Amazon are providing Israel with, quote unquote, the most advanced services that are used in the war on Gaza. Separately, Israeli officials are reported to have stated that without Project Nimbus, they could simply not have had the data storage and computing power they deemed militarily necessary. One Israeli security source explained that soon after 7 October, Israel's military systems were so overloaded they actually crashed. But with Project Nimbus and the public cloud, they began to exponentially expand storage and processing capability, which is effectively what the cloud and Nimbus enables. Project Nimbus, and with storing data on the cloud in this way, Project Nimbus also conveniently challenges efforts to collect data in the case Israel is brought to international courts. Just gonna have a check on time. As if all of this wasn't enough to put Google's dropping its ethics and no weapons pledge into perspective. This past March, Google announced its largest acquisition to date, valued at $32 billion, of a company called Wiz. Wiz is an Israeli-founded tech startup specializing in cyber and cloud computing systems. It was founded in 2020 by four former members of Israel's military cyber intelligence unit, this unit 8200. Wiz's technologies are already integrated with those of Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, Oracle, and Google Cloud. And just 2 weeks after, Google announced a partnership with Lockheed Martin, the world's largest weapons manufacturer by revenue. And this partnership will see Google's AI tech being integrated into Lockheed Martin's own what they call AI factory. According to press releases, the partnership seeks to revolutionize aerospace and defense industries through quote-unquote real-time decision-making, as well as quote AI development across global operations, including air-gapped environments, meaning in areas that don't have internet access. Of course, Lockheed Martin already supplies the Israel's military and has done so for decades. For instance, it's provided over 102 F-16 Sukhoi fighters, as well as attack copters and tens of thousands of missiles, and it already has integrated its systems with those of the Israeli military. But as the world's largest weapons manufacturer, their reach is far wider than the genocide in Gaza. Lockheed Martin is a massive supplier to the US military, holding nearly $460 billion worth of contracts between 2008 and 24 alone. It's been deeply involved in US border securitization and violence, developing technologies and providing aircraft to US Customs and Border Protection for surveillance of migrants, and also to US Homeland Security, and to a number of other states. With its acquisition of Wiz in partnership with Lockheed Martin, Google, founded in 1998 with an initial focus on online search and online advertising, and from there grown to become one of the world's largest and, according to a BBC article, one of the world's most powerful companies, has made clear. It is now a weapons company. Google is a weapons company, and I would add so too are Amazon and Microsoft. If we are to be generous, we might say that when Google and Amazon entered into Project Nimbus in 2021, they may not have been aware that only a few years later, the technological infrastructure they would build and provide would be utilized for the world's first AI-powered genocide, the mass assassination factory, that for over 20 months has not only destroyed hundreds of thousands of precious lives, but the institutions and infrastructure necessary for any people to survive and thrive. However, each company that bid on Project Nimbus, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and Oracle would have known without a doubt they were bidding on a contract involving data storage and processing for Israeli government operations, including its military, its leading state-owned weapons companies, and agencies and infrastructure associated with military occupation, with surveillance, and with settlements. In short, grave human rights violations. And they did so because Project Nimbus was, or is, as one Google executive stated, quote, the largest government procurement of a public cloud globally. And by engaging with it, they would gain what we call in business schools competitive first mover advantage in the rapidly developing area of AI and cloud-informed public sector services, including lucrative defense sector contracts for weapon systems development, integration, and automated warfare. To give figures, the military cloud computing market is today estimated to be around $11 billion in annual spending, and by 2035 is projected to grow to about $30 billion in annual spending, which is about 25 times larger than the Project Nimbus contract. As Emma mentioned, a few years ago I wrote an essay titled Making a Killing, Israel's Military Innovation Ecosystem and the Globalization of Violence. In it, I explored the history of Israel's weapons industries, which can be traced back to the 1930s in Palestine, when Zionist militias covertly produced weapons for use in terrorist attacks against British forces and Palestinians during the 1939 to 1947 Zionist insurgency, and later the Nakba. And how, after 1967, particularly after France instigated a ban on arms trade with Israel, Israel strategically invested in its state-owned weapons industries, developing weapons in conjunction with surveillance and violence, deployed for military occupation of Palestinian and Syrian territories, soon to be later, the war with Lebanon. As a result, by the 1980s, Israel had put itself on the map as a significant developer and exporter of weapons. And as this militarization of Israeli society continued with the expansion of settlements and their associated technologies of violence, such as checkpoints and the apartheid wall, and of course, again, the war with Lebanon. This essay also explored how, largely because of the occupation and mandatory military service, large sectors of Israeli economy and society were shaped to serve the military occupation and warfare. A key feature of Israel's military innovation, which is in part enabled by the rise of its weapons industries, which in 2003 reached a record $13 billion US dollars in arms exports, double what that was just 10 years prior, is the significant privatization and monetization of the occupation, as well as development of weapons and weapon systems, including surveillance systems, cyber weapons like the infamous Pegasus, and autonomous weapon systems. As a result, the distinction between Israel's military and its private sector has become nearly non-existent. For example, Unit 8200, its notorious military cyber warfare unit, is widely hailed as within Israel's tech startup scene, and is often described as having a revolving door with it. So many of its soldiers that work in that unit move on to found their own startups that then service the military, and vice versa. This is a point hinted at by several scholars, including Tarek Dana and Shir Haber, who write about Israel's weapons industries, and by Maya Wind, whose book Towers of Ivory and Steel carefully contextualize the development and complicity of Israeli academic institutions with military occupation and war. It is also a point made by Anthony Lowenstein in his book, The Palestine Laboratory. A key point of all of these works is that the techniques and technologies of violence developed by, for, and with Israel aren't restricted to Palestine. Just as colonial powers utilize technologies of violence across time in sites of colonization, we have known for a very long time that what happens in Palestine does not stay in Palestine. Weapons and weapon systems developed and battle-tested on Palestinians find their way to the global arms market. Drones and cyber weapons are two of many examples. And this genocide is no different, as evidenced by Google's acquisition of Wiz and its partnership with Lockheed Martin. Companies that built the technology that enabled the world's first automated genocide are taking their expertise globally. The commitment of big tech to militarism should absolutely terrify us. Google, Amazon, and Microsoft provide services that are regularly used by more than half the world's population on a week-to-week basis. Their technologies touch or enable the professional activities of companies, government agencies, nonprofits, and universities the world over, including our own. Together, they control two-thirds of the global cloud computing market, meaning two-thirds of how the world's data moves, is stored, is accessed, the totality of user data, personal and medical information, photos, finance, banking, online profiles, online behaviors, political views, professional activities. Data and cloud computing services that inform so much of how modern societies and modern economy functions. And now they are actively repurposing this technology, technologies initially developed to process, store, and enable user-consumer data for surveillance, for violence, for autonomous weapon systems that generate kill lists, systems that may soon be seamlessly integrated with the hardware and the munitions that eventually execute those kill lists. Big Tech's commitment to militarism reclassifies the global public cloud technology and the systems that they dominate, systems that digitally underpin, again, much of our work and lives, as dual-use technologies, meaning technologies that have both civil and military application. And in doing so, they link a significant portion of the world's population, including each of us, to genocide. This should absolutely terrify us. In 2018, around the time of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, Shoshana Zuboff published her book, Age of Surveillance Capitalism, a study of how corporations, particularly Google and Facebook, use their technology to predict, control, and monetize human behavior. In it, she also followed the work of Google's chief economist, Hal Varian, who himself identified several features of surveillance capitalism, including the drive toward more and more data extraction and analysis, development of new contractual forms using computer monitoring and computer automation, and using technological infrastructure to carry out continual experiments on users and experiments on consumers. Zuboff warns about the risks associated with the commodification and monetization of user data, and what societal complicity in this poses in terms of the deterioration of our individual self-determination, our individual privacy and rights, and democracy. She warns that the monetization and weaponization of data are one and the same. Yet the understanding of weaponization in her work doesn't cover what we are witnessing today in Gaza. Automated weapon systems trained on data generated through technologies of surveillance and control, where the objects of data are not user consumers, but are subjugated populations whose entire existence is shaped by those who dominate and control them. Where users in the traditional sense are not customers, but states and soldiers. And the customers slash co-producers are states engaged in genocidal violence, are imperial powers, and weapons companies whose modus operandi are predicated on perpetual warfare. In their recent book, Data Rules, Reinventing the Market Economy, my colleagues, Christina Alaimo and Yanis Kalinikos, explore the role of data in societal transformations with implications beyond surveillance and beyond the monetization and erosions of rights and democracy. They argue that data, data generation, data monetization have a profound ontological impact on our understanding of ourselves and the world around us. And they argue that it ushers in, quote, a massive rendition whereby social and economic facts are converted into data that in turn are both implicated in and govern the broader social and economic transformation of our times. Their view is not necessarily negative. In fact, they see possibilities for, quote, reimagining, rehearsing, and reconfiguring new societal architectures, new socioeconomic orders, and associated legal and governance mechanisms. Looking at the past 601 days of live stream genocide in Gaza, a genocide largely enabled by big tech's foray into autonomous weapon systems, it is extremely difficult to view this proposition as anything other than a dystopia. Decades of scholarship by researchers of information and data have built a huge wealth of understanding around how individuals are at the same time objectified and constructed as commodified data profiles and data objects, and how, through platforms and ecosystems, data is able to support new forms of social and economic organization and even spawn new industries. Too few examine the essential role data plays in the ideological and mechanistic dehumanization and control of marginalized populations, whose data profiles become ranked in order of preference on a kill list, where data monetization occurs at every stage, from surveillance systems that capture personal data without consent, of course, to servers that store that data, to AI models that process it, to the fighter jets, the bombs, the missiles, and the quadcopters that execute kill commands. I am speaking about the simultaneous digital construction of Palestinians as data objects in systems that, by their very design, digitally construe them as targets for elimination, and then, sometimes almost instantaneously, proceeds to bomb, bury, vaporize, burn alive, tear them apart in a context where food, clean water, and basic medical care is almost entirely denied to them. Violence that is increasingly automated and executed at unprecedented speed and scale. This is the assassination factory, developed and advanced by the largest, most powerful technological companies in the world, the likes of Google, the likes of Amazon, the likes of Microsoft, in partnerships with states and the largest weapons manufacturers in the world, bound by an ideological commitment to the monetization of geopolitical supremacy through perpetual warfare. Gaza is the testing ground for one of the most significant and terrifying technological transformations of our time: automated genocide, and big tech is at the center of it. Thank you.
Well, Samer, I think that was not only a talk for me. That was a very much engaging, empirical-driven talk. I was shocked. I was terrified of the level of embeddedness on everyday life. I mean, these platforms, we use them every day, and the level of investment. I mean, I'm a Palestinian. I've witnessed what's happening. But what you have said, just like, really build this broad framework of understanding how this genocide is automated, the level of mass killing and massacres that we've been witnessing and the speed of has to do with this, with what you discussed. I think personally you provided such great, very much needed data that it's very rare that we find. And I wasn't wrong when I said that this is the engagement of scholarship, activism, and moving forward I mean, the whole time while you're speaking, I was just like thinking, how can we act? And I think this is my first question, because these platforms are just like everyday based kind of platforms. How can we act? How can we boycott? How can do something regarding this? And also another question of mentioning the Hapsura, Lavendra, Where's Daddy, AI system platforms. Do they work all together systematically under the umbrella of Amazon, Microsoft, and Google? Or they're just like kind of separated? And why I'm asking this question, because this will also increase the level of data collected to empower and feed in the automated genocide that you mentioned. I will start with these two questions, and then we can collect more questions from the audience.
Thank you, Emma. I mean, thanks again for your words. I think it is quite terrifying, and working on this is has been, you know, putting these together and putting together an empirical narrative. It's something I've been working on for a few years now, and it's something I bring into my teaching as well. But really only in the last, you know, 6 months to 18 months has information really come out about this. So it's a rapidly evolving there's a rapidly evolving empirical understanding of what's happening and also how it happens and how this technology works. And I would say that I really owe my understanding to people in the No Tech for Apartheid movement who've been really quite active in getting this information out there. So I could not, maybe I've put together the empirical case in a particular way and brought some conceptual frameworks to try to understand what's really happening on a broader level. I really owe it to people internally at companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft who are releasing information and investigative reports that are published in The Intercept, Time and others. So this information is out there. You touched on the question of the first question of how we can act. I think really begs us to first step back and think about how this of how an understanding of what it means for the world's largest companies and the world's largest also the world's largest technology companies upon whose technologies and platforms so much of our own work is undertaken, and around so much how systems within society, from education institutions to companies to hospitals, you name it, run on these platforms. It has ushered in and kind of a new level of complicity, a kind of a passive complicity. It's enrolled at minimum half the world's population who use these services by affiliation into a kind of a, complicity might not be the right word, but I think it really begs us to step back and think about at a deeper level what it means for us. I think we need to think about that, and then from that we can develop strategies. Mm-hmm. That being said, for some time and well before Project Nimbus, there have been many efforts to circumvent the kind of control and domination of these companies in these markets. So there are alternative search engines. I mean, I know these are small things. Mm-hmm. There are open source. There's open source code and software for people to use. I'm aware of some university departments at some of the big unis in London that have stopped using Microsoft Teams, for instance, and are using alternative systems that are open source derived. But I think
the biggest layer of complicity is the social legitimacy that we give for using these services. And while it may not be entirely possible right now for us to avoid using Microsoft software, especially because of the cloud, where much of our information, so for instance, my university uses Amazon Web Services for their cloud hosting, and we all license Microsoft, the Word Suite, etc. But there are markers of social legitimacy that are, you know, more traditional forms of challenge. So, for instance, at universities, there are many universities that are invested, that hold investments in big tech. And many universities are having conversations now about divesting from military-related holdings. Often these try to put some kind of threshold, let's say, companies where 5% of their business or more is invested in military activities, but because Google and Amazon, Microsoft are so huge, it will be a long time, and hopefully never, that more than 5%. But so I think we've got to push in and around divestment. I would hope that large pension funds, for instance, Norwegian pension funds, have divested from Israeli banks and other companies that are involved in settlements, etc. So I would hope that there would be leverage for this, because it's not just about the genocide in Gaza. Project Nimbus services all Israeli government infrastructure. So that includes police, that includes settlements, that includes activities that the ICJ has very clearly stated amount to apartheid and you know, as an apartheid state and illegal, etc. And far longer before that. As universities, we tend to have partnerships. Some universities have quite a few partnerships with these companies and organizations. But I've also seen handbooks of how to sabotage, you know, small sabotage, for instance, by opening up thousands of tickets around software. It really forces a lot of labor of companies, etc. But I think one of the biggest possibilities at the moment is the mobilization of employees within these companies. In some cases, like for instance in Google's DeepMind, employees are attempting to unionize, and a big motivation for them is the Project Nimbus contract. But I think it's easy to be quite overwhelmed, just because so much of our lives, so much of our professional lives, our personal lives, our personal photos, information, is, you know, how we move around, how our systems move us around, transportation systems, etc., is kind of governed and underpinned by this technology. So I think there's a lot of work and thinking to be done around that. Now, we know, in terms for your second question, we know that there are other systems beyond Hasbora, Lavender, and Where's Data. There are many other systems that are being developed and all the time. We know that Lavender does feed into Where's Data. Initially, it had not, but it does feed in. So almost all of the data from Lavender is fed into Where's Data. And we also know more broadly that when systems are built, they often shape the type of data that then gets collected to feed those systems. Mm-hmm. So I do think that while these systems might be trained on existing surveillance data, I do believe, as you've alluded to, that it will push and spawn new forms and new mechanisms for data collection as well. New modes of surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
To capture new types of data, new types of tracking, etc., that would make these systems more quote unquote effective. So absolutely, these systems depend on surveillance, and as they are exported globally, it's no surprise that the agencies that are initially picking these up are for instance, like Homeland Security or U.S. Customs, etc. Agencies that, you know, as part of their core portfolio of activities are involved in surveillance and tracking and have at their disposal huge amounts of information of general populations.
Yeah, I got many questions like that bit when you said the AI system collects information to put a number from 0 to 10 about to what extent this person is engaged in resistance in Gaza. This is terrifying because the data by itself is biased, and the data by itself is could be like
it's imperfect. It's biased. But also, you know, these systems are designed to identify people for elimination. So it's and already we've heard many statements from top Israeli ministers and generals and officials, which were basically, you know, and media personalities, where they've stated that everyone in Gaza is Hamas, or everyone in Gaza is guilty. No one is innocent. So already there's this idea, and the surveillance data is already, through its very collection, through the occupation apparatus, has criminalized everyone. And when the features of these systems are kind of relaxed or expanded such that greater portions of people in the database can be identified as a power target, or where conditions are relaxed such that they allow for greater number of civilian casualties in a hit, that in effect already kind of criminalizes, you know, wider portions of the population. So yeah, absolutely. It is quite terrifying.
Yeah, it is. So to the questions, we'll be taking like three questions.